twists and turns, man, I don't blame you. I said, listen, I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man.
But, welcome to Barnstorming. This is Jordy Comis. Cindy, are you going to stay?
Yeah, I'll stay for a bit.
Okay, you're going to have to come a lot closer to the mic, though. like right there.
Okay,
Mark's always carries.
You're going to have to get intimate here.
Yeah.
conversation.
Okay.
Will you introduce yourself?
I'm Cindy Peltier, and I'm the director of the Community Zone here.
And I'm Mark Friedenberg, Democratic candidate for the 12th Congressional District of Pennsylvania.
Awesome. The 12th needs a nickname, you know, like the fighting 12th, but that's too obvious. Like, the expansive 12.
I'll go with Friedenberg's dozen.
Friedenberg, there you go.
Nicely
done. So Mark just asked me if, you know, we're talking about what is the nature of a podcast. We will do a one-on-one interview with Judy Herschel. I haven't reached out to Doug McClinko. Probably should. I'd be curious. It wasn't quite on my radar screen because mostly we focus on where, like, a lot of it's like where politics, but also social movement dynamics, like where they intersect, especially at state, local, and regional. So, kind of from that perspective, that's why this race came up. I have some questions. I really, you know, I've had the pleasure and honor of hearing Mark in two forums or debates, I think, so far. But I really want to kind of like have this more of a conversation, maybe be able to go a little deeper into some issues. We're talking about McClinko. Do you want to, can we just jump, since we were talking about that, do you want to talk a little bit about why you think McClinko might win versus Marino?
You know, one of the things that, I haven't seen any polling data, but one of the things after the 2016 presidential election, where a lot of people say, oh, I saw it coming, was that I was driving all around the northern tier and I saw all these Trump signs.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, everywhere I drive in the 12th Congressional, I'm seeing McClinko 20-1.
Wow.
Over Marino, at least. That doesn't necessarily mean anything, but I don't see Marino putting in the work. And I do see McClinko. He shows up at events that I show up at. And
yeah.
I think he's a serious candidate that Marino would be well served to take seriously.
He's a county commissioner. I don't know where, some county.
Bradford.
And my experience with the county commissioners, like, that's a pretty good base to start with because a lot of people know you because you, mm-hmm. you know, it's different than. I mean, Marino was an attorney, and of course he has his base in Williamsport. But, you know, it's just somebody who, the nature of the position often gives you the chance to be seen as likable because you're doing grant money for housing. And
You're executing.
Yeah, that's right. This is something I keep meaning to look. So I do, the yard sign thing reminds me of two things. Do we know if yard signs really correlate to political outcomes?
Yeah, I can't say that I've seen the data for it,
yeah.
I'm operating like it is.
It certainly feels like it does. It certainly feels.
I mean, I get this from the other side, which is sometimes local Democrats are like, oh my gosh, X, Y, or Z, this is not at all about your race, but in other years, they're like, there aren't any signs, they're not, you know, and I'm like, should they spend money on signs or should they be spending money on social media or other things? And so in my mind, I sort of think about the trade-off. So I was just curious if you knew if there was, like, good evidence that yard signs are a reliable predictor.
I don't know if it is, but for us, the campaign, and I love to talk about policy, and I'm happy to do that in however much depth you would like, but what I've seen for most voters, if you get them to know first, May 15th, there's an election, and then there's this person named Mark who's running, that's a really good start, and the signs are a good way to do that.
Right. Well, since we're talking about McClinko and Marino a little bit, this is something I want to talk about later, but you know about the lawsuit from Marino. Is there anything you feel like you can say at this point about it?
Yeah, I called into On the Mark last week.
Okay.
It's an outrageous intimidation. So the basic backstory, and here I'm going to stand up for McClinko's supporters, who I think have been wrongly targeted. They essentially wrote an email. I think there's some confusion if it was meant to be to a small audience or apparently went out to 80. And accused Congressman Marino of taking kickbacks in exchange for support for Big Pharma. Basically, he has now sued, Congressman Marino has sued the authors of that email, which said at the beginning, we are supporting Doug McClinko. It wasn't journalism, it was a personal email. He's suing them for defamation and invasion of privacy. And it's certain to lose, I can say that as a lawyer, as a politician or a budding one, it seems like awful politics. It makes you seem scared.
Awful.
Seems stupid,
awful.
Really.
Yeah. You know, you're talking about Marino not putting the work in. I mean, like, you're either vindictive as hell or arrogant as hell to think that this is going to play well.
Absolutely. And it just leads to a discussion of, this was what happened with On the Mark with Congressman Marino Defender, a discussion about what is a kickback. That's not a discussion you want to have if you're a congressman.
Look, you know, this is your first race, is that right?
That's right.
And you already know that.
Yeah, we talk about, and I said this on the radio too, and I teach this in class, the Streisand effect. The idea that by saying don't look at that thing that you're, her Malibu mansion, you draw further attention to it. And that nobody would have known, or only 80 people would have known about this email, but now hundreds of thousands do.
Well, that's, I didn't know it's called the Streisand effect. That's good.
I never heard that before, so I'm happy to know.
Wait, why Streisand?
So there was a photographer, I don't know if he was with a particular magazine, but he took photos of her Malibu house, and she wanted them removed from the internet. Mm-hmm. Well, now, if you first of all, it's very easy to find photos of her mansion because lawsuit, press about.
Right.
Arguably, Hulk Hogan's similar thing, except it appears that that was really about Peter Thiel attacking Gawker rather than his privacy.
Yeah, that's, I mean, to me, it's such a, as somebody who I try and fiercely defend First Amendment rights. This is really chilling. And I saw something, I really need to look it up, it's like the second I mentioned the podcast. It was a news article about a company that was suing some activists saying, your protests have hurt our brand image, and we can point to how much our brand image is worthless, like Goodwill, right? And so they tried to use that. And I was like, hey, hold on. It's one thing for an activist to like spray paint your trucks. It's another thing for them to engage in like, let's call it rhetorical combat in the space of symbols.
I think the framers kind of liked that. They liked the marketplace of ideas. It's intimidation of the lowest form, and it's part of a larger, ironically, an attack on the free press. Ironically, I had seen Doug McClinko speak probably a week before this lawsuit was filed, and he talks about we need to open up the libel laws, parroting President Trump, and I don't think we need to. And I guess this is slander, but it's actually, it's counterproductive. Like, now he's going to have to be, assuming, defending his defenders and First Amendment rights strongly.
Who is?
Doug McClinko, not literally in court, as a rhetorical matter, if he wants to, stand up for his people.
Yes.
Oh,
he's going to have to undo what he was saying about libel laws.
Yeah, it maybe means that opening up libel laws is just a political ploy.
Well, also, and we should stop talking so much about this lawsuit, but I think in a defamation suit, Marino's going to have to establish that it is not true that he took money from pharmaceutical companies that influenced his vote.
Right, and it's awfully hard to do that. Yeah. He's got the burden, and proving a negative is hard, especially when you're a public figure. They have to show actual malice on the part of the email writers, which is that they knew it was false, or that they recklessly disregarded the possibility that it was false. And it's destined to lose.
Right.
But he can spend time being deposed if he wants to.
Yeah. Well, instead of out on the trail talking to people, that's his choice. So there's no good segue for this, but I just kind of wanted to like give people a chance for you to talk about, not the typical like tell us your story, but like what were some like early experiences for you that you feel like were part of your political coming of age or your politicization?
Yeah, for me it is the. I went to Penn State and got my degree in information sciences. And so I was very early on really enthusiastic about the internet and its ability to affect social change. Since then, I've become more skeptical. Mm-hmm. And I've become more, I've become more cautious about how the internet can be used effectively to improve lives, because I think we've seen not only the 2016 election, but repressive regimes the world over have used it to restrict social movements. And so I am very much a First Amendment defender, and that's already caused a little bit of blowback, where there have been people asking questions about fake news and what to do about it. And my opinion is really we need to fight it out in the marketplace of free speech. Mm-hmm. We attack bad speech with good speech, not through the courts and not shutting down speech. So that's one set of experiences. The other is I wanted to go into cyber law, so I went to law school. And after law school, I went to go work for a firm that was suing the Wall Street banks that caused the financial crisis, really two firms. And through the discovery process, through seeing their emails, through talking to folks whose lives were ruined, and they weren't hard to find, it was all over the country, because of that greed, that really changed my view on big corporations. I'd come through you know, college, Penn State does a really good job of getting students jobs, but they tend to be for big companies that, mm-hmm. that recruit at Penn State. And I had a pretty pro-corporate viewpoint there. But I think, at least with regard to the Wall Street banks in particular, that is that experience of suing those banks, because they were absolutely liable, they caused that crisis, changed my views. And then after the 2016 election, not the result of the election, but the absolute extremeness with which the Congress...
That's normal for podcasts, okay. You know. We like these sound effects. Sometimes at my house, my dog comes by.
Okay. So we'll keep rolling.
Yeah.
The Muslim ban, the attacks on healthcare. There's this concept of forbearance from I had heard about in the context of this recent mm-hmm. book, When Democracies Die, that mm-hmm. you don't always exercise the full power that you have. That's part of what democracy is, that you recognize the legitimacy of the other side and you exercise forbearance. And I think this Congress and this president are working together, which is not what the founders wanted. They, mm-hmm. They're supposed to be checks, and they are not acting with forbearance. They are breaking all kinds of norms. They are breaking ties, using Vice President Pence's vote to get in extreme nominees for cabinet positions. Mm-hmm. The system is breaking down, and that was maybe the last formative experience that convinced me that I had to get involved.
Yeah. So, like, growing up, you weren't, like, the kid running for class president, or...
I did run for maybe sophomore and junior year, but, yeah, it wasn't my passion. Right. It was more of a way to get discounts on snacks. Yeah.
And was your family, you know, were they involved in politics? Did they take you canvassing or anything?
No, nothing like that. You know, they were, my dad's pretty staunch conservative, my mom has her own views, but they're not very passionate about it, or at least it's not something that, you know, we would talk about at the dinner table. And that's actually something that I'm trying to change a little bit through the campaign, not just with my own family, but saying, sorry, like, the dinner table now is a place where we have to talk about politics, mm-hmm. because if we don't, we divide ever further.
I had something about your, you're from Bucks County, is that right?
Born in Philadelphia, moved in when we were around, I was around 10, to Bucks County, and then went to Penn State.
When people say Bucks County, I mean, I used to live in Bethlehem, so I kind of know where that is, but, why Bucks County? Why don't they say the town they're from? I don't get that.
Oh, well.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I moved to Holland. I don't know if that's, maybe that's it. It's too confusing.
People go, like, they're from New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. I'm like, what does that mean? No one from Montana says, I'm from Montana. That, you know, they say where they're from.
Yeah, you know, it's about, I lived in Northeast Philly, and it was, you know, about half an hour north of there. Newtown, Council Rock School District.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Oh. You said something a little while ago that was really interesting. Oh, so I'm going to jump here a little bit. You're talking about this idea about forbearance in the book you're reading. Oh, that part of democracy is acknowledging the legitimacy of the other side. And, you know, that's interesting because I think one way that people run, especially in a district like ours, which, you know, most political operatives would say there's a lot of Republicans, you're going to have to get moderates and independents if you're going to win with a D after your name. And so an approach is to say, I want to be a conciliator. I'm going to work with people across the aisle. I mean, Obama, in my memory, he was very good about that, trying to say there's a new way to do politics, a different way. And I, you know, my own experience, especially local level, people will say, like, well, I don't want people are going to be very ideological. You know, in borough council, there's not a Republican or Democrat position on sidewalks, as far as I know. You know, to me, that's hard when you're coming from a liberal or democratic perspective because, you know, in fact, Chip, who was in here earlier, said this, we treat them like humans, they treat us like we're the enemy. You know what I'm saying? So, what do you think about that? Like, how can, I've seen some of your campaign, some of your style, but, you know, how can we campaign and win, but keeping in mind trying to preserve that norm? Does that make sense to the question?
It does, yeah. This is probably something I spend more time thinking about than anything else, and it's a good consequence of our primary system, which is that voters who are deciding who to nominate are thinking ahead to a general election and this exact question. And if it was uncontested, I wouldn't have to speak about it, at least.
Right.
And I'm glad that I have to. So I think that compromise in the sense that, say, when you think about the negotiation leading to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, Republicans watered down the ACA, and then gave up nothing, and nobody voted for it, and we got a weakened bill. And the lesson I take from that is that the not the Republican voters or Republican people, but Republican elected officials are not honest brokers. Negotiation with them, conciliation with them, will not be rewarded. It will not be reciprocated. If anything, it's viewed as a sign of weakness. Now, if you look at the registration numbers, you're right. It's a Republican district. Lots of people don't vote. There are a lot of independents, but based on registration. But I think if you think about it, not in terms of that, but in terms of the working class or the poor versus the wealthy, we're almost all on the same team here. This is pretty much a working class or poor district. And I think that by speaking to people about the issues that will meaningfully help them get a good job, get education, get health care, that's a way to win people over. And I think another way is we have this opportunity because, at least on what I'll call our side, the progressive, democratic, liberal side, there's undeniably this wave of enthusiasm that if we have high school students talking to their parents and grandparents about, hey, grandma, you know, I know you've always voted for a Republican, but, you know, here's a new face, doesn't have baggage with the Democratic Party, wants to help you get fast internet so we can have FaceTime, you know, calls on Sunday. I think that's the kind of thing that might win some people over. So certainly not attacking. You can't attack voters or their viewpoints and win anybody over. Nobody responds to being told that they're wrong. But by reframing some issues, that's a way that you can get them to see things in a different way.
Perfect. Yeah. Oh, Cindy's back.
Yeah, that was perfect. Thank you for that answer.
let me sort of dig in a little bit more because and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, when I've heard you in debates and I've seen some of your commercials, something you said on when we were in Williamsport Thursday, I think was, I think that we make change in Washington by not compromising on our ideals, and we need to deliver a majority, right? Is that consistent with your message?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, vote for me, Mark Friedenberg, because I will be part of a majority that can really do the things that need to be done, and you were very animated when you're talking about what I would call populism.
Tom Marino's never going to back universal health care. Tom Marino's not going to support a fight for a $15 minimum wage, and a compromise is what, $8 an hour? I mean, that's not anything that's going to get people excited about it. There's no middle ground there. He's not going to move on that, nor would have Doug McClinko. The idea of we're not going to chip away at the free press or lop away at it, the idea that we're not going to allow these attacks on the judiciary and law enforcement to continue, there's no compromise on that.
So let's say it's the general. You assume you've won the primary, and they're gonna come after you about minimum wage. They're gonna say it's gonna kill jobs. And so I mean, how do you get around that framing?
There's a couple of ways. One way that I try to do it when I'm speaking with people one-on-one is to say, well, first, you know, do you think that there ought to be a minimum wage at all? And they almost all say yes. It's worked for a while. So then I just say, well, look at what it is now compared to what it once was. Adjusted for inflation, boom, it should be more than $15 an hour already. Some people get that. Now, there is some holdup or some reticence about, you know, do we need to phase it in or have it tied to the zip code and make exceptions for small business. And that's, I think, partly practical. That's partly for Democrats. You know, I've been making this point that we've been conditioned to negotiate against ourselves, that we don't take bold stances. We are always waiting for what the Republican blowback is going to be. They're going to blow back on anything. If we called for a $7.35 an hour federal minimum wage, they would blow back against that. So that's one approach. The other approach is to step back and look really, really big picture, which is just say, and everybody agrees, we're the wealthiest country in the history of the world. Don't you think that people ought to get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work? People seem to think that they do. Well, do the math, 40 hours a week at the minimum wage, you're not going to be able to get by. You're not going to be able to take care of yourself, let alone family, without relying on other government services. And when they see that there's actually all this other money that's being spent essentially to pay these workers in an indirect way.
Mean like SNAP benefits,
yeah, exactly,
housing?
Exactly. They get that. And then I can also talk about, for people up at the northern tier, you see a lot of workers crossing the border into New York because all of the states that have raised their minimum wage, all the states that surround Pennsylvania have raised their minimum wage above the federal, and we have not. And so workers, understandably, they respond to that incentive and they'll go to New York, and that's helping New York's economy and not Pennsylvania's. So if anything, it's just a way to stay competitive. Now, that's just for Pennsylvania. I'd like to raise it federally. I'm running for Congress. I can't raise it just Pennsylvania's. But I think it's important to raise it federally so that other states you know, it might take a little while, frankly, before we can take back the House in Pennsylvania and take back the Senate. But I think there's a real good chance of doing it in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And we can look at other states, right? I mean, we can look at states and localities that have raised the minimum wage, and we see that not only does there not, not only do we not see this decrease in jobs, but we actually see increases. You know, you look at California and Washington, Illinois and others, and all of Pennsylvania's neighboring states, that you see the basic idea of why we have a minimum wage is that so that the workers have enough, not only that they can live, but then they can spend and contribute to the economy. And we have, I have a great deal of faith in the innovation of American workers to be able to support wages that are a living wage while also, you know, continuing to have jobs and have affordable products and services.
I mean, I like all of that. I'm just putting on my, like, campaign, like, working in a campaign. And, you know, it seems to me part of your solutions rely on being able to get into conversations with voters. You know, like, what do you think there should be a minimum wage? Like, if you have to reach, I don't know how big a congressional district is.
760. Well, have 760,000 people.
So yeah. 150,000 voters or something.
I think a little bit.
But
more.
you know where I'm going. Like how are you going to do that through other kinds of media? Like, is there a way to do it?
Well, yeah, through other kinds of media besides. I think the conversations are really important, and so my plan for the summer is, you know, starting May 16th, is to drive around and have conversations with people, and it's going to be very different. You know, I understood the idea of we have primaries, but I feel it very directly. So you talk to Democrats, Doug McClinko and Marino, to the extent they do, are talking to Republicans. And starting May 16th, then we have to start crossing the streams a little bit. At least I do, maybe they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So the face-to-face conversations are really, really important. Other media, sure. I mean, we're doing quite a good deal, I think, of direct mail. In this, and that's not a conversation, but it's a way of name recognition, primarily. Social media, absolutely. I think we have a pretty good social media operation. The flip side of it is because of the low broadband penetration, a lot of folks aren't seeing it. On their phones, they may. TV and radio, still effective, billboards. But really, I think it's the direct conversations.
Yeah, I think it is too.
And it's not going to be easy, no doubt about that. I mean, I'm going to need an army of people to do it with me.
Let's see. Framing. So this conversation we've had a lot on our podcast, and it's something that I'd love to think about. So one thing I hear the people on our side say a lot is, "Oh, the Republicans are so good." What's that guy who always writes the memos? Frank something. You know, Lutz. Frank Lutz is like.
Oh yeah.
You know, he. You know, I think he's the one who came
the
up with the death tax.
Yeah.
So I have my own opinion about this, but I'm wondering if you think there are framing successes from our side and what some of those are, and if there are framing problems or failures that we should, like, work on.
Well, you know, the successes are my campaign manager, Dan, sent me a piece.
I like Dan a lot.
Me too.
I just want to say that.
and he's a good guy, and he sent me a piece. He didn't write it, but it was called "Keep It Simple and Take Credit." I don't know if you've read that. It may not be famous, but it was sort of a critique of the way the Democrats brand things like the ACA or Obamacare. Which it's complicated. It takes a long time to yield any impact, and when it does, because of that, the voters may not see, like, oh my gosh, I can buy insurance now because of the ACA 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We need things that are simpler, that are easy to understand, and that are tied directly to clear values.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Medicare for All is a signature issue in this campaign, I think for all Democrats, which is, it's a simple idea, and people get it, and there will be immediate benefits. I think that's a success.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Democrats are reluctant to have these bold ideas. That may be changing. But, you know, a critique of Hillary is that, you know, go to my website to read the 40-page PDF. And that may be over-exaggeration of her critics to some extent. But I couldn't point to one thing. If you ask me right now, I couldn't point to one thing that she stood for, mm-hmm. really. But I'm trying to emphasize on the pro column, because there's a policy side, and then there's a fair play or like a democracy side I see at stake in this campaign. They may be equally important, but on the policy side, you're going to get Medicare for All, and you're going to get fast internet that's affordable. That's the, and maybe even that's too many words, you know, fast, cheap internet. That's what I'm trying to sell. And I don't want to brand anything that Republicans do negatively. That I think it's unnecessary and counterproductive. So a thing like a death tax, I wouldn't want to do that personally. But I'm happy to do a good job.
You mean you wouldn't want to take one of their ideas and turn it and death taxify it?
Exactly. Yeah, because I think it's just it's not my way. But I do want to do a good job of selling my ideas.
I'm in my head playing with somehow Fast and Furious, but replace Furious with a word that means Medicare for All.
Oh, not Fast Internet.
Fast Internet, so Fast and
oh, okay, Fast and
an F word that's like, you know, I was going Fast and Fecund, but that's never...
not federalized, people don't like that, but yeah.
You know, but something...
yeah, I like that.
That, you know, that's good. So one, this came up the other day a little bit in the Lycoming debate, but you brought up, you know, antitrust and how we need more of that, and actually this totally relates to the rural issues. You know, we're more vulnerable here to kind of trends towards concentration of economic power in internet and healthcare. But, you know, I was thinking, this to me is one, this is just my hunch. Most people don't know what antitrust is. Trust is a good word. Antitrust, what the hell?
Yeah.
We should call this pro-competition. These are pro-competition policies because that is what they are, you know?
Yeah, I like that. And
you can have it. I won't charge you.
Okay, well, it's a good frame, and it's really important, not just on the consumer side, but on the employer side, too. A lot of small towns in this district and all across the country are basically company towns now at this mm-hmm. point. That company might be a Walmart, but they've gotten so big that they reduce there's no competition on the employment side.
Right.
And you might be stuck in that town that
right.
you feel because of your healthcare, that it's prohibitively expensive in many ways for you to move. And that really strangles the economy.
I'm going to go a bit in the weeds, but this is what you get when you have, you know, an ex-academic, or I'm still not, I don't know what I am. But anyway.
You're Geordie.
Yeah, I'm Geordie. There was a guy like in the 30s who wrote a long book about the power of chambers of commerce and also the American Manufacturers Association. And the upshot of this was that these entities actually do a lot of work in sort of ideological, like kind of controlling the ideology at the local level. And that makes sense for me because, like, at a kind of basic, like, why don't small businesses understand that Democrats are often on their side? You know, it's this classic thing, like, I'm going to sound way off on a tangent maybe, but, like, it always bugs me when people are like, well, why do poor people not, you know, vote their interests? I'm like, well, you're a rich liberal and you're not voting your interests. Why do you, you know what I mean? Like, well, why do you have a hard time imagining that people are shaped? Their voting is shaped by things that are other kinds of issues that are, like, lenses with which they understand economic issues. But back to the Chamber of Commerce, you know, it's kind of like the Chamber of Commerce always goes to, like, the lowest ideological denominator. Like, if you're a moderate or even a progressive business person, the Chamber of Commerce isn't going to be out in front sort of talking about your interests. It's always going to be with the person who's most worried about regulation, most worried about these things. And they've got local and national and state chapters, you know what I'm saying? So they act as a kind of ideological guide rail that I think is often kind of overlooked. You know, my candidate, Jen Rager Kay, who's running for State House, she went to a Chamber of Commerce thing. And it was, you know, first of all, it's funny, very few business people were there. It was mostly just candidates talking to each other. But, you know, that kind of put it in my mind. So,
Well, let me just, this isn't exactly on point, but
that's okay.
Maybe it's a piece of information that's worth knowing. I went to the Center County Pomona Grange legislative dinner a few weeks ago. A pretty Republican crowd. Their number one issue by far, to the point that they had a pre-printed banner, was broadband. The entire mm-hmm. legislative session of their mm-hmm. dinner was dedicated to broadband, combined with a healthy critique of steel tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
These are people that we can win over.
Yeah, absolutely. You were talking about, a little bit about sort of campaign models and strategies, and you're talking about conversations. This is something that, you know, as I think about framing and messaging and ideas, I'm always like, how do I get into the hunting clubs? You know, like, how do I get into the churches? Like, that's where a lot of these conversations, especially I think in a rural district, happen. That this is a hunch, you know, I don't have any proof of it, but, you know, sometimes political operatives who parachute in for presidential campaigns or congressional campaigns, I think they tend to get focused on media markets and that kind of stuff. I'm like, well, maybe that works in Philly, but around here, there are some TV markets that and radio that matter, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I'm, you know, Dan and I made a choice. I mean, the reason I picked Dan and then together, we're not using any kinds of consultants or anything like that, because it's just not effective. It's a waste of money. You just you get in by asking. I mean, so there was actually a very formative experience. I could have listed this when you asked at the beginning. Mm-hmm. We had done a protest outside of Glenn Thompson's office in Bellefonte, other congressional district. And we were wrapping up, a friend and I, and we were, you know, taking all of our signs away. Older gentleman, clearly a farmer, kind of looks over at us. He was in the parking lot, side eyes us, and then kind of walks over. He says, "Oh, I guess you guys are the opposition, huh?" Mm-hmm. And we get to talking, and we say, "Oh, no, actually, we're constituents like you." And then he tells us about how he's a dairy farmer, the issues that he was there to talk about with Glenn Thompson. And then he invites us a couple weeks later to go on a four-hour tour of his dairy farm, and, mm-hmm. and told us all about his operation. Point being, you never know unless you ask, you try. Mm-hmm. They say, "Hey, can I come into this club?" They'll probably say yes, mm-hmm. and they might even respect that you did. And you never know just by talking to people what kinds of connections. I mean, I met you at an organizing our revolution, event. So you never know how things are going to come together, and the only way to miss them is to not try.
Mm-hmm. One thing I've seen, I don't know if you would have seen this, there was on The Intercept, there was an article about this guy in Colorado. His name's escaping me, but he's in a primary. But he recorded surreptitiously Steny Hoyer, trying to get him to, if people don't know, Steny Hoyer is what, the number two Democrat in the House or something like that, whatever. He's in the House leadership, minority leadership. And he's basically pushing this guy to get out to make room for somebody that the DCCC or the DNC thinks can win. And that, the other guy, it'd be help if I can remember the names, but we'll call him, Billy. That's not his name. But anyway, he's a lawyer and a veteran and kind of hits all these boxes that, in my experience, people who are very, very on the inside of Democratic politics want to hear. Rich, has a fat Rolodex, a veteran, a lawyer, won't make big business people freak out about those things. And the other guy had worked in Obama, in the Obama administration, and is himself an entrepreneur. I mean, he had a lot of good things going for him. But anyway, so you haven't seen this news story.
No, I haven't.
But you know this story, right? Like, either in Pennsylvania, either the Philadelphia and or Pittsburgh machine, Rendell's people, they want to put their finger on the scales. I mean, there was an op-ed in New York Times recently by a woman saying, "Oh, you shouldn't complain. This is what parties are supposed to do. The party elites kind of protect the party from its base." This is the kind of thing that makes my head explode. So, the main question was, I was just wondering, as much as you can disclose, like, have you had contact with state and national Democrats? Like, have they wanted you to run a certain way? You said you don't have any consultants, but...
Nothing.
Oh, okay.
I know some of those people, but I've been happy with the way that, or maybe pleasantly surprised. There hasn't been any kind of interference.
Do you have any, like you've run before, you haven't held office before, is that right?
I've not run before, no.
So, I was gonna ask. How long would you say you've been a Democrat?
My entire voting life. So I'm 16 years.
So I'm just setting up. Like, do you have your own critiques of the Democratic Party? Like, if you weren't running, maybe put it this way, if you weren't running. Or even before you were running, or even after running, I don't care. Like, are there things you'd like to see the Democratic Party do differently about anything, either at the state or national level?
I think the clarity question is a really important one. I was at I organized a kind of a town hall or a meet and greet in Potter County. It was a Thursday evening, I think it was in January, bitter cold, in a completely out of the way place. And we had a nice turnout, and some really dedicated people came. And one of them asked me just the most direct question. She said, "What is the Democratic Party's platform?" And I couldn't really answer it for her. And that's maybe by design, that the party doesn't decide candidates or what the platform is, at least in the early 2018 for the
right,
term.
Right.
The trying to even just explain what we stand for is a really important thing. And I know it gets exhausting to do all that navel gazing. And so I have my answer for it, which is that we stand for poor and working people against corporations.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all it is. And that drives almost every decision for me, except for the democracy stuff, actually. I mean, I think they're not opposite, but it's a separate track. But on the policy side, that drives everything for me.
Well, maybe, say it again, poor
and working class Americans.
Help them confront what corporate America does to them. Okay, yeah.
And I'm not even saying the rich, because many of the rich folks that I know are you said they vote against their interests.
Yeah.
They know that they're doing it, and they're happy to do it. And so they're certainly not the enemy.
Yeah, right. That's true. So maybe the corollary to that is helping frustrated and angry voters deal with what would be the analog of corporate America. See what I'm saying? The democracy stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually...
Unfindable representatives or something.
Yeah, or also, or just helping... It's like helping the people with the pitchforks find the door and get in.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah.
Where the door is the political system, right? So I'm trying to play with... Because I think that is part. I think especially the gerrymandering stuff has really crystallized for people the ways in which they feel outside of the system. I get very frustrated with sort of old school liberals who will say like, well, you know, people aren't voting so that, you know, they get what they deserve. I'm like, you know, come on. Like, you know, they have voted in the past and nothing's changed. Like, they feel the writing's on the wall. I just, yes, of course we need people to vote and we should encourage them to vote. But that kind of... This is just a very self-satisfied kind of critique.
Yeah, you have to give them something, and the something is for some people it's kind of that good governance or that democracy stuff. Like, it's good that we vote. For other people, it's like, give me this thing, you know,
right.
Help me get faster internet, help me get healthcare, you know,
yeah.
Help me repay my college loans.
Yeah. So
may I say something?
Of course.
Because I just want to react to what you said. And I think that sometimes that's what happens with Democrats. You know, they think, well, Democrats are the bleeding liberals, and they're just for the under you know, the underclass, and so it's a loser critique. You know, it's how people think about Democrats a lot. You know, and so I liked the things that you said about the specifics. Like, really get down to specifics. Like, what is it that you're bringing to the table? You, Mark, what are you bringing to the table? What are you going to be fighting for? And, you know, that whole thing about the internet and everything, I mean, that is real, that's what lots of people can get behind.
Arguably, the wall was another example. It's
a
simple thing to understand. That would be a pointless.
It's got to be simple, and it can't be amorphous like that, because it seems negative somehow. It seems, you know,
right.
Loser-like.
But I think a mistake a lot of Democrats and liberals generally and first-time candidates make is thinking, especially because they believe in education and meritocracy, and so they think, if I have the right policy positions and I put the right papers on my website, I'll win. And I'm like, look, no. Like, you need to have a clear message that people can understand. Yeah. You know, politics to me is about stories first.
That's right. It's about stories that people can wrap their heads around. And so I hope that you do some of that tonight at the League of Women Voters.
I'll refer back to the podcast I recorded earlier.
Please do. And that Cindy asked you to do it.
Yeah.
Because really, it is the kingpin of how people are going to, whether they're going to vote for you or not.
I think you're right.
Hear that. They're looking for that. They're looking for that little kernel. What is it that Mark's going to do? You know, what is it that he believes in? You know, these whole amorphous kinds of things is not going to do it.
Well, that's the thing. Maybe people would find it surprising, because I'm a teacher and a lawyer, and you would expect it to be long-winded. My default is to be really short, because I think people's attention spans are short. If you give them a bunch of stats, tell them about this agency, that agency, forget it.
Yeah. But, you know, I want to come back. I'm glad you said that, because I want to come back to what you were saying about the minimum wage. And I love that fact, too, about if it had been adjusted for inflation. But, you know, and I've even had people, as somebody who has a you know, more education than I need, I've had people in the political world say to me, like, don't include facts, don't include facts. I'm like, no, don't include 10 facts. Like, one good fact. Frame the right way, and I think a great campaign ad, hell, a yard sign, that graph, 1970, 2015, minimum wage, actual minimum wage adjusted, make it big enough so people can see it. It tells the whole story. Another one that I love is, you've probably seen, is our productivity, our economy going up, worker wages flat, the difference is how much value the economy's made. Actually, was my question in Williamsport, was like it actually referenced that.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can see quite clearly our economy has made a lot of wealth, and who got it? Not workers.
So you want to talk about automation?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, it's one of the biggest threats I think that our district is facing. If you look at a lot of the different sectors, I mean, healthcare is going to be transformed, education is going to be transformed. I think there will still be jobs there, but there is going to be automation. It's closer than a lot of people think. But, you know, fracking is, you know, how many jobs do we need there compared to coal mining? A lot of transportation, trucking jobs, I'm convinced, you know, they're going to be eliminated.
Did you see Logan, the movie?
Yeah. I remember those trucks well, yeah.
That scene in Logan, if you haven't seen it, there's one scene, which is not important in the movie, but there's self-driving trucks, and I thought, that is going to do so much for to help people understand.
Yeah.
And there are, I think I looked this up, 1 million truck drivers in the United States.
Yeah, and it's a huge number that are based in Pennsylvania and travel through Pennsylvania. And, you know, the self-driving trucks aren't going to stop at the truck stop and contribute to the economy. Maybe, you know, charge up their batteries or something. But you know, that automation is an Amazon and the retail, you know, de-retailization of a lot of this district. How many emptied out malls are there throughout? I drive past a lot.
Have you been through Shamokin? Oh, that's maybe not being your district. Is Snyder County? Yeah.
Snyder is, yeah.
So it's called Shamokin Dam. I've yet to find the dam. It's not near Shamokin, but it's in Snyder County. It's called the Strip. The mall there is collapsing.
Yeah, I mean, even in State College, where the economy is doing well, the mall is, you know, it's a shell. And the so the Amazon, and really just Amazon, is transforming. In Walmart and Target too are, I think, being disrupted by Amazon. And it's a serious problem. And I think at that debate I alluded to, I'm not prepared to advocate for any particular policy yet, but things like a universal basic income or a job guarantee, we need to be thinking about now, because when it hits in, I don't know, 2030 or something, we need to make sure, because it's going to be like that. You know, people are going to lose their jobs.
I think it is hitting now. And I think, you know, among maybe some progressives, the party line is, we have to talk about how globalization has done this and we haven't protected from workers from globalization. And I'm sure that there's a lot of it there, but it sounds like you've seen some of the data that automation is as much or more causing a change.
Yeah, I do. I think it's more than globalization. And, you know, I not that this is necessarily anything that voters care about. You know, I teach a course on globalization and world trends at Penn State. And, you know, I think generally it's good when we have more markets that are available for us. You know, we want it to be fair. We don't want other markets to, other countries to be able to undercut our workers unfairly or steal our intellectual property. But I like having a market, say, you know, with a number of Pacific nations that the U.S. is a meaningful player in and not China.
I mean, to me, sorry to jump in, like, this is one of these simple ideas, and when I talk to economists that I know, I'm like, why doesn't anyone talk about this? Like, it seems so obvious. When we negotiated NAFTA or Pacific trade agreements, you take the minimum wage and you peg everybody's minimum wage to each other so you don't have a race to the bottom mechanism. And I remember very clearly when Clinton negotiated NAFTA, they were like, well, environment and labor standards will do a side deals. No. Like, this is a clear political choice. Make it, bake it into the deal, right? Otherwise, you create these race to the bottom situations, and you know, at least then countries are competing on real comparative advantage. Like, we're way in geek land, but Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. This is something I read once. Was, you know, actually he was only talking about those natural factors, right? That Scotland is good at sheep and Italy is good at olives. You don't try and grow olives in Italy, and you don't try and do wool in
or the reverse,
whatever. Yeah. Yes, you don't grow olives in Scotland and you don't grow sheep in Italy, although sheep are happy in Italy. But anyway, because they're better off trading. And he actually explicitly said he didn't mean wages, right? But in the Chicago School of Economics, this got laundered into, well, you know, basically we're, you know, countries are competing on how much they're willing to exploit their own population. That's how I think of it.
Yeah, and I mean, even some of our...
And we signed up for it. And to me, when I say the Clintons, I mean Bill Clinton primarily, and I think Hillary seemed at the time to... She didn't want to have it both ways, too. I don't want to really open up these wounds, but it was always like, I don't hate Hillary because she's a woman, but she wanted to get credit for when she was a first lady, but then also not count that as. And I was like, well, which is it? Where, you know, were you at the table and part of Bill Clinton's legacy, or weren't you?
And you could ask the same thing about TPP, which, you know, yeah, which we helped draft and then decide.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, let's maybe do a couple of other maybe funner things if people lasted this long. I'm going to ask this. You don't have to answer it. Do you have any ink? You have any tattoos?
Oh, no, I do not. No, it's...
Because I think your primary opponent does. I think...
Oh, is that right?
I'm going to ask her this, too. I think I saw something on her calf. I thought that was kind of an interesting gender... I mean, I'm only a little bit older than Judy, but I was like, this is the thing. Like, 20s and 30-year-olds have so many more tattoos, and I just... Because you're in your 30s, right?
Yeah, I'm 34. My mom made me promise that I wouldn't, and I think maybe it's outdated, but I think for Jewish cemeteries, or at least there's some prohibition on having tattoos. Maybe
interesting.
Maybe that's passed.
Have you gotten any pushback on being Jewish?
No.
Huh.
Has it ever even come up?
Not to me.
Okay. Do you have any, you mentioned the democracy book, but I don't care about that. Have you had any fun books you've read recently? And by recently, I mean the last 12 months.
Honestly, books have really fallen off.
Yeah. Or do you have a favorite book that you like?
Well, in my stump speech for a while, I was talking about, and it's true, I read my girls this, there's a series of books called Ordinary People Change the World.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely adorable. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Yeah. So the Abraham Lincoln one.
Yeah,
we read that a lot. Honestly, I don't think I've read any like novels or anything fun.
You're a little too old for this, but Harry Potter, like...
I love the Potter books.
Okay.
Yeah, I went through them at least twice.
Okay,
yeah.
That's good. Let's see. Is there something that like politicians have been around who've been elected? Like, is there something politicians do that's kind of a pet peeve for you? Like anything?
One of my aides and I, we were talking the other day about saying up and down the ballot. We don't like that phrase.
Mm. It's interesting.
It just doesn't really mean anything. What do they do? Yeah, I mean, just kind of the, a general kind of air of theatricality at all their times or some self censoring or something like that. Who knows? You know, I may lose 10-1 in the primary. Who knows? But I'm not doing that. I'm just being myself.
Right.
And
it makes for great podcast material.
Thank you.
I was really glad I stayed.
Yeah, she was like, oh, politician, Jordy.
No. I just knew he was going to run the show here, so I was just wanting to listen.
I think I agree with you. I think what you're describing is something similar to me, which is like, I hate it when I hear them pivoting.
Yes.
I'm like, just answer the first question first. Mm-hmm. And then if you have to sort of try and pivot, but, you know, I can't think of a great example, but, you know, let's say it's the trade thing. What do you think of trade? You know, well, I think it's really important to acknowledge, what do you think of NAFTA? I think it's really important to acknowledge how workers, you know, are doing. I'm like, no, just, what do you think of NAFTA? Just answer that question first.
Yeah.
When everything's a pivot. And I think that that's the thing that, for me, when I try and help, I don't have a lot of experience, but when I'm trying to help candidates, I'm always like, and I think you're in this school too, authenticity first. And when you say one thing to one group and another to another, that will come back to haunt you. And the other is, if you're always pivoting, people know that. Like, I was a chef a little bit, and you know, and the guy who owned the restaurant, I don't know why everybody knows who that is, but anyway, he'd be like, well, why are you bothering to put like fresh parsley on it? And he's like, no one notices. And like, they don't know that they notice, but they notice at a deeper level, right? And so when you walk into a restaurant that's cares about what it's doing, you pick up on those little cues, you know. And if you walk into a chain, you may like the food, you may like the value for a dollar proposition, but some part of you gets it, right?
This is maybe not similar at all, but I've been thinking about it a lot.
Artisanal campaigning.
Artisanal campaigning, that's right.
That'll work in Portland.
Yeah, craft stuff.
yeah, craft stuff.
Yeah. The difference between, you know, like...
Merino's a Bud Light kind of camp, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm an Old Forge.
It's foreign.
Oh, yeah, good.
Yeah.
That's really good.
What did you say?
It's foreign. Because,
The difference between, like, a Toyota and a Lexus, I'm no car guy, but I think the frame and a lot of the... is very, very similar, but it's like 1,000 little things about the way the door...
Right.
Sounds differently when it closes, and the difference in how the stick feels when you move it up and down, you know, near the steering wheel, and those kinds of things. It's a lot of small things, and a lot of authenticity or not authenticity. I agree. I think people may not. The old cliche of like you want to have a beer with them. I don't think that's really relevant. But is this person gonna not be persuaded by money when a lobbyist, you know, tries to push it into his hands or something? I think people will get that.
Okay, last question. I should have asked this before the goofy fun stuff, but I did want to ask you. Like, you know, you've been campaigning for months?
September, so maybe 9 months.
So how would you say that you've grown or improved as a candidate?
I think that I've gotten better at saying less.
Mm.
So that's an important one.
Mm.
I think that I've gotten better at having a sense of what the audience wants to hear in terms of a different message or a different thing that I'm saying, but just a different way that they don't always tell you what they're exactly asking. They sometimes will ask something different to find out the deeper thing. And I think I've gotten better at being able to see what people are really asking.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've gotten better at delegating. Has been really important for a truly a grassroots campaign. You know, we use a lot of...
Oh, shit. Hold on. That will be a problem. Oh, I'm sorry, you were in a really good rhythm, too.
This is a stupid lady right here.
In her own car?
Yeah.
Can I help her?
I don't know.
Is she the key?
She's
she too hot? What's
coming? No, she's laughing, talking.
I don't know. That's so funny.
I'll go stare balefully.
Yeah. Oh, she's on the phone. I think she's. I think I will, because it's at.
Yeah.
It's at 7.
It's at 7.
Yeah. I'll grab a slice.
Yeah.
Is it? I don't even know where the building is. Are we close to it now?
No. I mean, yes, but you wouldn't want to walk.
No, you can't walk to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, but you'd be all
sweaty.
I got
yard signs. And, yeah.
She doesn't know what to do to shut it off.
That's too funny.
She's calling whoever.
I probably should. I don't know. Have you heard the podcast? I don't expect that you have. I'm sure
you're
busy.
You know, Dan, not that I don't want to, but just as a time saver, Dan listens for me. And
yeah.
Same reason he hasn't read any novels lately. He's busy.
Yeah. I'm terrible at that. I've got like 15 books on my bedside table. And
I used to always pride myself. Like, I would keep up on The New Yorker. Yeah, that was my thing. I got 12 piled up now.
Yeah.
And I know there's good stuff in there for a politician.
I'm not running for office and I can't keep up to it, you know, because it's too many good things in there. And the stories are long and you got to stick with them.
How old is your oldest?
4.
Oh.
The oldest?
Yeah. Up to 4 and 2 year old.
Oh, I thought you said 4 and 2 year
old. No. How old is the oldest? So my wife wrote a young adult novel called The Rosemary Spell, which is set in have you read it?
No.
Do you know about it?
No.
You don't know this?
I don't know.
Oh. So it's set in a fictionalized Lewisburg, and it's a girl, Rosemary, who's like 12. And she's a voracious reader. So like next to her bedside table, she has her emergency books for like life emergencies. You know, as like A Wrinkle in Time, Harry Potter. I can't remember what other ones. Anyway, she finds a book in this old house, which is I live in an old house, that in a cabinet. We did have a cabinet we couldn't open, which was like weird, and that kind of got her going. And so it was a book that supposedly was Shakespeare's in the novel. And like the idea that Macbeth is cursed, you know, this for theater people was because he actually used witchcraft in the play. And this book was his notebook and it has magical powers. And Rosemary and her best friend accidentally set off a spell. Mayhem ensues and they have to resolve it. And so,
yeah.
I mean, I can't give you a copy because it's hers, but if we get you one, she'll sign it.
Okay, I'll read it.
Do you have any nieces or nephews that are that age?
I do.
All right.
But I
wait
for myself.
Okay.
But wait, now I have a bookstore story for you.
Okay.
Do you know Forefathers Bookshop? A guy named Keith Bailey owns it in Center County. It's mostly like political and history books.
Are these down in State College? Because I feel like I don't know any good bookstores in State College.
It's not in State College.
Okay.
Well, Webster's in State College. I mean, it's a coffee shop, but
it's a coffee shop.
But is it in the like main kind of?
It's downtown. Yeah.
Is that what's called downtown? Like where Beaver Avenue is? And
yeah. I mean, well, but Forefathers is like out in the sticks, but it's a former bank. So he bought the bank, and then he's got like shelves in the safety deposit box area, but he was never able to unlock the safety deposit boxes.
Oh, how awesome.
And it's like, oh, I'm dying to find out what's
no
in those boxes.
Kidding.
Yeah.
You can, I mean, you get the right drill, the right locksmith. It's expensive.
Maybe he wants to keep it as a J.J. Abrams.
God, that is a great premise for a play or something, or for like a. That's awesome.
What's in those boxes? What is in those boxes?
Because I don't know, but like if a bank shuts down and, you know, do they eat? Go around and make sure, of course, right?
I mean, the people who have the key.
They must have, you know, emptied them all.
And then they just relock them or something. I'll bet there's not much in them. You could get X-ray. Oh, this is good. Okay. All right. Do you mind starting over, like, how have you grown as a candidate? I'll just cut that
part.
I might come back and add the books.
I'll give you a better answer than I was intending. Okay. Something else popped in my mind. So as a candidate, some simple things, like about how to speak. Some management things, like how to delegate in a grassroots campaign, and we've got a lot of college students who are helping out, which is great. And I think the other thing is I've gotten better at being authentic. That first campaigning, I felt like I was going to be a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama, and I was going to be poised, and I was going to speak like them, and I speak my own way, and I've become more comfortable in that because I started doing it, and I wasn't smoke. And so I think that it's a way to it's more comfortable for me, it's more fun for me, and I think voters are responding to it well.
Great. Do you have any last questions or
no, that what you just said is it made it for me. Yeah, I mean, I think the authenticity is what people are not seeing on both sides of the aisle. I mean, you're just getting politicians and politicians speak, so to speak authentically like that you know, you take a risk, because if you're being authentic, sometimes you're going to say something and people are going to take it wrong.
It's possible.
But I think it in the end of the day, that's what people are really looking for.
And it's the truth. Like, I'm really just, I'm a teacher and a dad, and I'm just this guy who wants to help. And sometimes I have to tell people, like, you're going to have to believe me. But other than that, it's just, I have to show it by being myself. Yeah.
I've been to Belfont, Southmont, Westmont, Wilmsdorf, Nordmont, Dormont, Lebanon, Holmesworth, Cedar Springs, Bowling Springs, Chess Springs, Centerbridge, Centersport, Leesport, Williamsport, Brackenridge, Lumber City, Central City, Lake City, Clearfield, Westfield, Wentfield, Richfield, big deal. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed the valley, fair man. I be the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Beachland, Wilpen, Tunnelton, Conestoga, Bakerton, Curry Run, Smoke Run, Sanatoga, Slickville, Smithville, Flicksville, Maxtoney, Youngwood, Edgewood, Hopwood, Punxsutawney, Whitehall, Blue Ball, Center Hall, North Pole, Telenor, Laredo, let's go. I've been everywhere, man. I cross the valley, spare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Been to Stump Creek, Penns Creek, Pine Creek, Chambersburg, Middle Creek, Blakeslee, Falls Creek, Shepherdsburg, Johnstown, Allentown, Shepherdstown, Lords Valley, Daisytown, Doylestown, Downingtown, Cherry Valley, Plain Grove, Mill Grove, Mechanics Row, Swissvale, Ferndale, Carbondale, Monongahela, oh well. I've been everywhere, man. I cross the valley, spare man. I be the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Oh, I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I cross the valley, spare man. I be the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man.